7:07 in the Twin Cities. Great to be with you on a Saturday night. Well, I am very fortunate to work at WCCO Television and also WCCO Radio with wonderful people. And I like to highlight when I see something that's a pretty great story to look at it and try and figure out what we can learn from it. And my colleague, Liz Collin, did a story that aired this week that has gotten an extraordinary amount of response. It has been viewed thousands and thousands and thousands of times. It is a story about a family that bought a new home, and within a few months, it was infested with snakes. And it's something that obviously I think turns most people's stomachs. But we actually are going to play Liz Collin's story, and then we're going to talk to a representative, actually the president of Adams Pest Control, about how out there is this, what should you do, what should you know, what kinds of precautions can you take. So, Jonathan, we've got Liz Collin's story ready to go. This is Liz Collin's story, which I believe aired Monday on WCCO Television. So let's listen to this.
We're looking for holes, cracks, and crevices.
Typically, you'll find them along the siding.
This is a runway right here.
Like a couple of crime scene investigators,
that's an access point.
They treat the property like a puzzle, piecing together.
Here we go. Here's one.
Probably most homeowners' worst nightmare.
I'm okay here. Yeah. Yep.
Once you find the den, it's pretty easy.
The pest control guys pull 5 snakes from hiding in less than an hour.
Think it's great that they're not in my house and they're there, right?
But today's find doesn't truly tell the hell Angie Whitley has been living through. The evidence of that lurks in her basement, now torn apart and littered with snake traps. As a nurse and a single mom, Whitley spent years renting a townhouse in order to save enough for a down payment for a new start.
It was clean, new carpet, new paint.
This split level in Oak Park Heights seemed like the perfect neighborhood for her 2 kids to grow up in. Several walkthroughs and an inspection yielded no trouble. But 45 minutes after closing on October 5th, plenty of it slithered in.
I brought my first sort of box in downstairs to my bedroom, and I found a snake. And one quickly turned into 3, 4, 5.
Oh, God.
Today, it's 6 months later, and I'm about now 95 snakes that I found inside my house.
That's 95 inside.
You can see one that just came out now.
A few hundred more outside.
In the snake world, this is up there.
Angie Whitley now knows a garter snake den is somewhere under her property, which sits close to a marsh.
Water creates a big void underneath the foundation. That's where the corner of her house is.
The perfect location for a reptile attracted to heat and to each other.
They're in their little ball.
Whitley has spent more than $13,000 herself trying to rid her family of the problem, ripping up her finished basement to tightly seal off any potential cracks.
If you can fit a pencil through, they could fit through.
And pumping out 40 gallons of water from a large hole she found in the foundation.
We really thought that that was the problem.
Still, the spring has brought the snakes back.
Here's an opening.
Adams Pest Control has now donated their services to try to locate the snake den.
A lot of sleepless nights.
Well, Whitley now sleeps upstairs on the couch and stays out of the basement, desperate for relief and for this sickening puzzle to be solved once and for all.
We're going to get it. It will be done.
Liz Collin, WCCO 4 News.
And that was my colleague Liz Collin on this horrific story. You've got a single mom who finally, after years of renting, wants to have a home that for her and her kids. And minutes after closing, the inspections turn up nothing. Minutes after closing, she finds all of these snakes, and she's been dealing with it ever since. Well, you heard the reference to Adams Pest Control. Joining us right now is Todd Lisi, the president of Adams Pest Control. Todd, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yep, you got it right.
Okay, great. All right, help us out, Todd. I mean, this is just a horrible story. What is happening here?
Well, snakes are cold-blooded, so that means they can't regulate their own body temperature, so they're always looking for a warmer place to live, particularly in the winter. And her house represented that warmer place.
And this is Oak Park Heights. There are certainly many families. It's a wonderful community that live in Oak Park Heights. You know, as Liz put out there in the story, you know, you go through the inspection process. It's not easy to buy a home these days with the inspections and all the things you have to go through. I mean, what advice do you have to people?
Well, it's kind of hard to inspect for every last detail. I mean, if you're inspecting to try to find, you know, the presence of something that might be trying to overwinter and hiding anyway. So you might be able to find openings, but you don't know if those openings are being used or not.
I guess what I found just horrifying about Liz's story, which was very well done, was that it literally, within minutes of the closing, she started finding snakes. Is that something that happens often?
I wouldn't say it happens very often, but when you're on wetlands, that's just an area where there's more snakes around. I had snakes at my house in Maple Grove in my first home, and it was a new home. And I got one snake in the spring one year, and the next year I caught two inside, and that's when I decided to start catching snakes on the outside before they would get inside. In the next two summers, I caught 38 snakes on the outside of my house.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, okay, so let's talk about that, because it sounds as if where you had your first house and where this single mom had her house does have some similarities. You're saying if a home is built on what was once a wetland or a diverted wetland, that puts you at greater risk?
Or near it.
I mean, or near it.
And
Minnesota has a lot of wetlands, and there's been a lot of development. And this has been a big debate for many, many years about the encroachment of development on wetlands areas. So this is something that people are facing, you know, just about every community in the Twin Cities metro area and across the state. There's a lot of development in areas near or what was over once wetlands.
Yeah, I remember there being a story in Apple Valley, I think, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where they had built a house. And it was basically, there was the yards in that area was basically one massive snake den. And they were trying to figure out what to do with it.
Well, let me ask you about this, because one thing that Liz mentioned in her story was that they determined that the house had been built sort of over a snake den. Is that, I mean, does that happen often? I mean, can you determine that?
I don't know if that's the case for her house. You know, a lot of times when you build a new house, you know, the excavators call it punching a hole. They dig a hole to put the foundation in. They dig a hole that's bigger than they need for the house so they can put the forms in. And then they build the blocks or pour the cement foundation or whatever. And then the ground settles afterwards, and they backfill next to the foundation, and that ground sometimes settles. So you can have settling underneath the slab, which is the concrete in the basement, or underneath the front step. And in my case, I think the issue was underneath the front step.
But I would think that having a structure with concrete and the foundation and all of that would disrupt any kind of nesting area. Or is that, am I just way off here? Obviously, I'm certainly not an expert on these kinds of matters, but I would think that they'd move.
Well, yeah, they might move away during the construction process, but then once the house is built and things settle, they come back and they find a cavity. You know, snakes aren't very good diggers themselves, but they'll take a mouse burrow and make that into a home for a small den. And so they'll take a woodchuck burrow and make that into a new den. And if your slab or front step, the soil underneath it has, you know, kind of shrunk down over time and settled, that creates a nice little cavity. And again, they're cold-blooded, so they can't warm themselves up. So they have to come out for sun when they're cold, and they have to, you know, seek something that's warmer when it's something that's colder when they're too hot in the hot days.
How are they getting inside the home, though?
Well, I think she, in her case, had some structural issues with the foundation. In my case, the house was a poured foundation, and I could not find any holes. The only thing I could suspect was something underneath the front step, because I knew that was a spot they were congregating, and who knows what the construction was like underneath the front step, and I certainly wasn't going to tear it up to try to find out.
Okay, so it might be a problem with the actual construction. I do think we probably have to take a quick break. Todd Lisi is our guest. He's the president of Adams Pest Control. Todd, can you stick with us? Because I think a lot of people have questions here. And I guess I'd like to ask you, when we come back, what should consumers look for? What can they expect if they hire somebody like you? What is the most, you know, difficult pest to get rid of? Because I think it's something that's very, very troubling and frankly scary for a lot of people. So hang on there. We'll have more with Todd Lisi after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with studio coordinator Jonathan Lowe. At the beginning of this half hour, we played my colleague's Liz Collins story about a woman who moved into a home in Oak Park Heights. And even though it passed the inspections, she found out within minutes of taking ownership of that home, it had snakes both inside and outside the home, and she continues to deal with it. My guest is Todd Lisi. He is the president of Adams Pest Control. Todd, what advice would you give to people when they are purchasing a home, and also what advice would you give to them if they have even remotely a problem that's somehow close to this?
Well, the big thing is I would recommend you hire a home inspector, first of all, and I know she did, but it can be difficult sometimes to spot some of these issues. But obviously, if you have someone who kind of knows what they're looking for, they can at least advise you of what the risks are and what they did find. And if they can find if they were to spot a snake or a shed skin, obviously they should bring that to your attention. But otherwise, sometimes you can even see burrowing outside near the house.
And what is the burrowing of a snake or other? I mean, does it look just like a little hole?
Yeah, it's just a small hole. You know, in my first house, I had landscape rock next to the front step, and on the other side, I had cocoa bean mulch with some hostas. And on both sides, the snakes burrowed in and out. And so I used to put the landscape rock back over where they would burrow. And within a day, they would move that rock and come back out.
So the snakes would move a rock?
Yeah, just a small little rock, you know, just like river rock kind of thing.
Wow. Let me ask you, and I know this is not because, I mean, your expertise is obviously pest control, but is there any options for homeowners in terms of liability or disclosure, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, yeah, you're right. You're kind of entering into an area with me that I'm not supposedly the expert, but I do know I just bought a house myself in October. And homeowners, when they sell a house under, you know, state disclosure, have to disclose if they have issues. And if they knew that, if this particular homeowner is selling, if they knew that they had a snake infestation, they probably have some liability.
Okay. What, and again, in terms of pest infestations, what is the most common that you come across?
Well, the one that most commonly people get concerned with real estate transactions are mice. Snakes are pretty rare. A lot of people have ants and spiders and whatnot. Even bats can be a concern, because if you've got bats, you've got a lot of guano and you've got a buildup of something that's really not healthy to be around. And I just had a former employee call me yesterday that they're dealing with bat bugs, which is something he never had to deal with when he worked for us 15 years ago.
And I'm sorry, a bat bug?
Yeah, it's like a bed bug, except for they normally feed on bats.
Ooh, yay, yay. Ugh. Okay. Oh, my gosh, which means that there are probably bats there, too.
Yeah, he knew he had bats, but his wife had found one bug that looked like a bed bug in his daughter's bedroom, and his wife found another one in their bedroom, and he was calling asking for advice on what to deal with it.
Wow. How difficult, okay, so somebody is in the unfortunate position of having these kinds of infestations. What is the most difficult one to deal with? Are they all difficult? I mean, it sounds like a lot of these issues are structural in nature.
Yeah, if they're the type of pests that are on the outside that are heading in, that's a structural issue. In other cases, like bed bugs and roaches and things like that, they're not so much living outside in Minnesota going door to door. That's more of a pest that gets introduced.
Wow. You know, let me ask you this, because I know that there's been a lot of discussion and debate about climate change. There's no question, I think, you know, whatever the cause, you've got temperatures that are more moderate than they were a couple of decades ago. Are you seeing any changes? You've been in this business a long time. Are there some things that are happening more often now than they used to?
You know, that's a really good question. When I first got to Adams, which is a company my dad started in 1971, I was always looking at the winter weather to try to figure out if I could predict how the next season was going to go. And I gave up trying to predict that a long time ago. Clearly,
a lot of other people, but yes.
Yeah. Clearly, when we have different weather patterns, we have different cycles of different pests. So certain years, when it's hot and dry, we'll have more box elder bugs. In other years, we'll have more bees and wasps. I think in my 21 years, we've had about 3 years where it's just been a ton of bees and wasps. And this year, with very little snow, and even though it wasn't super cold, but the cold temperatures we did have, we didn't have that insulating layer of snow on the ground, which does insulate a lot of pests. So it's possible we killed off a lot more pests this winter, even though you think of it as kind of a mild winter. We just didn't have the snow. So sometimes you think in terms of temperature, but you don't think in terms of snow cover.
Wow. Okay. Let me ask you, this is just a problem from my own backyard, box elder bugs. Why do some homes have box elder bugs and others don't?
Well, they typically come from the female box elder bug tree, which might not even be on your property. It could be somewhere else, somewhat nearby. But they can also be found in silver maples and some other trees. So in the again, in a particular year, they reproduce and they reproduce again and again. And if it's hot and dry, they'll go through that cyclical cycle, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, and their populations can grow exponentially. So that particularly hot summer, they can really just mushroom up in quantity. And then they're looking to overwinter. And in nature, they crawl underneath mulch or underneath the bark of a tree. And some of them just find your house as an attractive place to try to overwinter.
And again, they are linked to a specific tree, you said?
Yeah, typically the female box elder bug tree. And those are the ones that drop the seeds that look like helicopters when they drop.
Wow. Okay. I will check into this. Like, there's a box elder tree.
Yep. Box elder tree. And, you know, I don't really recommend you cut down trees to get rid of box elder bugs. But, you know, some people will go to that drastic measure.
Interesting. All right. Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I don't think that there's anybody around who hasn't dealt with, you know, some kind of infestation. And I think, you know, the story that Liz Collin, my colleague, did was just so dramatic, and it certainly has gotten shared thousands and thousands of times. And I think people were just so horrified by it, because here's this person who, you know, does everything she can to purchase a home and goes through the inspection process. And it's shocking, I think, to a lot of people that something like this could happen. And you're saying it's pretty rare, but it does happen, right?
Yeah, we because that story was instantly shared around the country, we got calls from people in Pennsylvania and North Carolina and all over the country, even somebody from England calling about the story. And you know, a lot of people were just very appreciative and posting messages to our Facebook page thanking us for helping a single mom out.
Right.
So.
Well, yeah, and you are helping, and wow! So you even got a call from the United Kingdom because of that, because it is. I'd be freaked out. I mean, that's hard, you know, and it's hard. It's a hard situation. Well, anyway, listen, Todd Lisi, thank you so much for joining us, and great insights. And it's kind of creepy, scary stuff. But I guess we're glad that there are people out there like you who can help us try and deal with it.
Yeah, well, thank you. And we are holding a job fair at our office on Wednesday from 11 to 3. So if people are interested in having a career in being a pest management professional and helping people out, we'd love to talk to you on Wednesday.
Okay, well, it's Adams Pest Control, and it sounds like you've got a booming business, sir.
Yeah, well, we've had 46 straight years of growth, and even through many poor economies, and bugs don't seem to know there's a recession out there, so we've continued to grow every year.
Wow. Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much, Todd, and thank you for helping this woman out. And again, I think my friend Liz Collin did a wonderful job with that story. And it's frankly creepy stuff. So, again, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and thank you for the help for that woman.
Yep. Thanks, Esme.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Yikes. That was just, what was it? The bat bug? I have never heard of that. That is a new one.
Neither have I, but I figured that I was just about to say to Mr. Lisi that you have supplied Esme Murphy with a full new set of nightmares that will continue with her throughout this evening.
Anyway. Wow. Okay. All right, folks. We are going to take a break. We have a more positive, like, story on nature coming up. And this is actually a really interesting book. And think about it. What if you had to answer this question, what are the 10 plants that changed Minnesota? And there are actually, there's another book that's been written about the 10 plants that I believe changed the modern world. I mean, think about it. You know, it's a fascinating discussion. And our next guest after the break and after weather will talk about what is, in her view, the 10 plants that changed our beloved state, which does have a lot of creepy crawly creatures creeping and crawling around. So anyway, keep it here. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 7:35 in the Twin Cities, 65 degrees. My goodness, a nice mild Saturday night. I love these kind of warmer spring and going into summer evenings. It's just really, really special stuff. My next guest, you can hear her here often on WCCO Radio. She is often on with Denny Long as part of our Smart Garden Show at 8 a.m. on Saturdays on WCCO Radio. Mary Minor is a professor and extension horticulturist at the U of M Landscape Arboretum, and she is the co-author of a new book called 10 Plants That Change Minnesota, and she is joining us now. Mary, thank you so much for coming on at this late hour for you.
My pleasure, Esme. Glad to talk with you.
All right. Well, let me ask you, it's great to hear, and I know that many people probably hear you with Denny Long on Saturday mornings, but let me ask you about this book. How did you happen to decide to help on this book?
Well, it's two or three reasons. I love plants. I love working with plants. But I'm concerned that many people don't see plants, and they have what I consider to be plant blindness, which has actually been identified first by some botanists. The fact that many people see animals and are more aware of animals than they are of plants. So I hope to raise people's recognition of plants in writing this book. And then to think that just a few plants, as few as 10, could have really made a difference in the economy and impact in our state was kind of fascinating to me, to try to think that, wow, well, what would those plants be? And if we wanted to pick those plants, how would we go about doing it? So I got the idea in about 2000, well, actually, it was on sabbatical in 2011. And I did see another book, this book called 50 Plants That Changed the Course of the World. And Bill Laws wrote that book, and it's a worldwide look at plants and their importance. And so from that, I thought, again, well, what would that look like for Minnesota? How unique would Minnesota be? So we started by having the public nominate plants.
Oh, and that's great.
yeah, we had over 500 nominations from the public, and we had about a three-month time period in 2012, where through the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, the public could nominate plants. So the publicity was great on that. The media, WCCO, we talked about it on the radio, and people nominated a lot of plants. And then we got together a team of judges, about a dozen or 14 people that actually, many from the U who specialize in plants, the dean of the Agronomy and Plant Genetics Department, Nancy Elke. We had the president of the Minnesota State Horticultural Society. We had Bob Quist, who is the director of the Oliver Kelly Historical Farm. I asked President Kaler from the university to be on the committee, and he sent his wife, Karen Kaler. And we had people from industry. Susan Bachman-West was on it. So after we looked at the 500 nominations and had them organized, we had about 3 hours where we looked at six different criteria to select the 10 plants that we thought made the most difference.
Right. And this is a book that's out that people can purchase. It's
right.
On Amazon. I assume it's in bookstores as well.
Yes.
So you can actually go and purchase this book, and it's a beautifully done book. And in terms of this whole process, I imagine that there were a few plants that immediately zoomed to the top of the list.
Yes, and I think most people will think automatically of these, the almost 8 million acres of corn that we have in Minnesota and almost 8 million acres of soybeans. Yes, those people thought about those right away. Wild rice is another one people think about. And after a few minutes, if you think about the nickname for the city of Minnesota, the Mill City, people realize wheat was really an important plant, and the lumber industry with white pine. So those are the plants that people come up with right away.
All right. So those, and those probably got many, 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 many nominations. But then U.S. also had to research, you know, exactly obviously corn is so prevalent here in our fabulous farms around the state. But, you know, you have to go into the history of growing corn here in Minnesota.
Yes, we look at the history of the crops, and my co-author, Susan Davis Price, she was really great at writing the historical aspect of each of these crops. So she starts kind of at the beginning with a brief history and the history throughout the years in Minnesota. So that's a nice specific aspect that's tailored for Minnesota. But some of the other plants, maybe like the more modern ones, purple loosestrife is a shock to people that we selected that plant. But as much as that it has been an invasive plant and kind of more of a negative plant in our environment, through work that the Department of Natural Resources did, and many citizens in the state raised these beetles that were biologically controlling purple loosestrife. And so schools and 4-H groups and Eagle Scouts raised beetles that now are taking care of the purple loosestrife. They actually feed on it, and they only feed on purple loosestrife, and they have kept it in check. And so where we used to see homeowners or landowners, Department of Natural Resources spraying to control purple loosestrife to kill it, the DNR does not do that anymore. They don't need to because the biological control has been a success story.
Well, and I guess it's probably that's really interesting because you put purple loosestrife out there because I guess not only, you know, people work to get these beetles that can control it, but I think it also made people aware that Minnesota, with all our beautiful and wonderful plants, also has a large number, as do many, many other states, or probably every state, of invasive species. So it made people think. So in that sense, I suppose it is really important. I guess people are sort of cheering for the good plants. So are you saying there's a little bit of controversy around that one?
There is. There's controversy around that, but that is kind of the poster child of the invasive plant that we learned how to control. And so we've really turned a corner on that because it is no longer increasing in its acreage or scope at all. It's it's really held in check. And in some locations, it's actually decreased. So it's a success story of kind of modern technology handling invasive plants.
Right. And of course, there are so many. But it's interesting. I think Time magazine has run into that where they name the person of the year, and sometimes it's sort of a bad guy. And people are like, you know, and it's about the person that's really had the most impact. But it's really made people, and Purple Loosestrife has made people, I think, here in Minnesota, look at what is a natural species, what is the species that we want, you know, the original species, and how to control things. So that was a controversial one. What were some of the others, like the next few? I mean, was it sort of duking it out? Did all the plant people kind of get in a room and kind of think, argue, or, you know?
There was some duking it out as far as the number of agronomic crops. You know, we talked a lot about sugar beets, and sugar beets are very, very important up in the Red River Valley.
Absolutely.
And they have a huge acreage, and there are some interesting cultural stories with minorities that have come to that area of the state because of the need for labor and sugar beets. And so that sugar beets was one that I originally thought that was going to be one of the top 10. But when we actually looked at the economic impact, the dollars that it contributed, it was nowhere near the corn and soybeans, alfalfa, and wheat. So over time, and you know, with the culture and the economics, that we kind of duked that out. But I have to say that another one I forgot to mention right away that was the number one nominated by the public was apple.
Yay!
Yes, and so sustenance was one of our six criteria, you know, just food, a great food source. And because of the history of breeding at the University of Minnesota, we have very unique apples, and the Honeycrisp is certainly made us very famous, and it's worldwide that it's grown now in Australia, New Zealand. It's called Honey Crunch in France, in Europe.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Oh, so I didn't know that. I mean, and obviously, I mean, the University of Minnesota really, you know, it is so known internationally for the plant sciences and you know, to the bees and the veterinary medicine. I mean, I'm not sure the people here really understand how well respected it is. Obviously, not just here across the country, but it sounds like worldwide as well.
Yes, that's very true. And the breakthrough that came with Honeycrisp was really the texture of that apple, the crunch that it had. And there are other apples now that are coming on the market. New York State has one called Snapdragon, believe it or not, and that is very similar in texture to the Honeycrisp. But yes, that selection.
Are we dealing with plagiarizing apples here? Or?
No. There are so many different parents to choose from, and even if you use Honeycrisp as one of the parents, there are so many genes, and they have so many combinations that you come out with so many different progeny.
All right.
So they aren't identical; they're just similar.
Mary Meyer is my guest. She's a professor and extension horticulturalist at the U of M Landscape Arboretum. You, of course, can hear her often on Denny Long's Smart Garden Show at 8 a.m. on Saturdays. But we're talking to her because she is the co-author of 10 Plants That Changed Minnesota that is out, is available on Amazon, everywhere books are sold. What has been the response to this book?
Oh, it's been wonderful. People love to guess the plants. That's pretty much what people say right away is, I think I can guess those. No, wait a minute. And they usually get about five. And then, you know, I have to say, now you have to think broad, and you have to think about those, the different criteria that we use. I think the one that is probably the last one that people guess, if they guess it at all, because I say, now think about the acreage around all the homes. All the homes that are in Minnesota, and there's a plant that's in probably pretty much everybody's yard and everybody's landscape. And they say, you mean grass? You mean turf grass? Lawn grass? Because when you look at the acreage in lawns and the amount of money that goes into lawn care, that is a big economic thing, and the other issue was the environmental issue. And in the book, we talk about, we have a section on the environment for each one of the 10 plants, be it positive or negative, the effect that this plant has on the environment. So with lawns, we have a list of things you can do to take care of your lawn that will minimize your inputs and help it be a positive effect on the environment.
Are there plants whose role, of the 10 plants that you have in your book, are there plants whose role has changed over time? I mean, my guess would be that people are spending more on their lawns now than they were 40 years ago, or is that wrong?
That's true. The biggest thing that they're putting on their lawn today compared to 40 years ago is water. Automated irrigation systems are much more common today than they were 40 years ago. And with a year like we had last year, you hardly had to ever turn your irrigation system on as a homeowner. So that's something that people can still use irrigation if they use a moisture sensor or a soil sensor to help, so that equipment operates only when you really need to. Because you know, many people just have it on automatically running endlessly, and we really don't recommend that. And there are ways that you can do an audit on your system, make sure that everything's functioning properly, and then put the sensors on it so that it really only operates when it needs to.
All right. Let me ask you about soybeans, because I, you know, in my job at WCCO-TV, I spent a lot of time sort of on the road driving through, you know, some of the wonderful agricultural areas, you know, just outside the metro. And I just feel as if I see more and more soybean fields than perhaps I did 20 years ago. Is that my imagination, or is that something that is happening?
No, that's very true. That's very true. Soybeans is a relatively new crop for Minnesota. Of the ones that are listed here, that's certainly a huge gain in the acreage of soybeans that are grown now. Soybeans are grown for oil as well as forage. So they can have two different uses. And the soybeans, many of the soybeans that are grown in Minnesota are actually exported to China. And so they go by rail over to the West Coast, Seattle, and then go by boat to China. So we grow the type of soybeans that China likes, and much of their soybeans that they import is actually for food, for human consumption. So that's kind of an amazing story, but it's a great export for the state of Minnesota. And soybeans have really infiltrated our foods, many of the products that we use. We have a two-page table in the book, one page on human uses and one on industrial uses for soybeans. So where newsprint used to be, well, I'm not sure exactly what it was. It was almost a toxic ink that was used to print newspapers years ago when I was growing up. And we used to tell people, don't use it in your garden because of the ink, the toxicity of the ink for mulch or whatever. And today it's all soybean-based. So there's no toxicity at all anymore in the ink that's used for newsprint. So there are just many, many uses. Okay. Crayons. The crayons are made from soybeans, and, you know, who would eat a crayon? Well, you know, it's everywhere eating crayons. And so it's really, they're a non-toxic a base that they're made of.
Well, Mary Meyer, listen, thank you so much for joining us. And again, the book is 10 Plants That Changed Minnesota. You are the co-author, and it's a fascinating look at a different kind of history. And again, it's available just about everywhere books are sold. But thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating discussion and a different way of looking at how and why we are the Minnesota that we are right now. So thank you so much.
My pleasure, Esme. Glad to be on your show.
Absolutely. All right, folks, we are a little late for a break. When we come back, I'm going to preview the next hour, which is going to be an in-depth look at a story I did 20 years ago, or many stories I did 20 years ago, The Hunt for Andrew Cunanan, and a story I did a couple of days ago with a lot of help from my colleagues. It is 65 degrees in the Twin Cities, 756. Esme Murphy with you for another hour until 9 o'clock. I want to let you know that in the next hour, we are going to revisit a story that I did. Actually, I did many, many stories on this 20 years ago. I followed and began tracking a series of horrible murders here in Minnesota. The suspect, over a three-month period of time in 1997, ended up killing five innocent men. The last person he killed was Johnny Versace in South Beach. The murders started here in Minneapolis, and I was following them 20 years ago because I worked at WCCO Television. And so I put together for the 20th anniversary, because a lot of people are doing this, a story that aired Wednesday night. So we're going to replay that. We're going to talk to one of the people I interviewed for that story then and now. And then we'll take your calls at 651-989-9226.